Chapter 15. Disengagement. On February 12th, Jonas Savimbi withdrew his forces from Silva Porto and fled 200 miles south to Villa Serpapinto, where he planned to set up a temporary headquarters and prepare his forces for protracted guerrilla warfare. At Serpapinto, he hoped to receive a final resupply of CIA arms and funds. The CIA intended that the French Hoods, who still had 3 months remaining on their contracts, would provide leadership and technical assistance to the guerrilla army. The Hoods were joined by a young European couple, a husband-wife photographic team, who would keep the CIA apprised of UNITA's adventures. Footnote: CIA headquarters had foreseen that it would soon be too dangerous to risk one of its own officers in Savimbi's company in the Angolan hinterlands. Hence, the European couple was enticed away from their plantation in another region and sent to Savimbi's headquarters. End footnote. But neither Savimbi nor the CIA had yet grasped the speed with which the Cuban juggernaut would crash through UNITA's puny defenses. In 3 days, the Cubans blasted UNITA out of Serpapinto, and Savimbi fled east. 2 weeks after that, on March 1, 1976, Savimbi appeared at Gago Cotinho at the far eastern border of Angola. The CIA immediately began to airlift arms and food from Kinshasa. The FNLA was faring no better than UNITA. On March 2nd, the last FNLA contingent fled north across the Congo River into Zaire. Roberto's mercenaries traveled overland to Kinshasa and disbanded. The 150 Brits returned to England, and the 30 Portuguese who had gone the whole distance with Roberto in Angola dispersed to South Africa and Europe. Captain Bento made his way to South Africa, where he examined the possibilities of developing a guerrilla force from FNLA remnants in southern Angola. Eventually, he gave up and emigrated to Brazil. In March 1976, Boeing was given permission to deliver the 737 jetliners to the MPLA. Boeing technicians went to Angola to install the radar systems in the airports. Gulf delivered $125 million to the MPLA and resumed pumping Cabinden oil. William E. Colby retired, perhaps more troubled by 2 years of fending off congressional committees than by the unfortunate paramilitary operations, Phoenix and IA Feature, which he had run. With him into retirement went William Nelson, the deputy director of operations. Ed Mulcahy was designated as ambassador to Tunisia. In a previous tour there, he had been ordered to supervise the expenditure of an accumulation of blocked local currency on the construction of a palatial ambassador's residence. Now fate had decreed that he should return to enjoy its splendor as his retirement post. Larry Devlin appeared at Mulcahy's swearing-in reception on the 7th floor of the State Department, only to be reminded by Mulcahy that he had not been invited. Sheldon Vance retired to open a consulting office in Washington, advising clients about Zairean investment opportunities. Jim Potts took leave for some much-needed rest, then departed on a tour of African stations, leaving Carl Bantam to sort out the problems of disengagement. The new director, George Bush, inherited the burden of extricating the CIA from Angola while dealing with a furious Congress. Congress knew all too well the CIA had ignored the intentions of the Tunney Amendment and was still trying to send military support to the liberation forces in Angola. Bluntly threatening to review the agency's overall budget, it subjected Director Bush to a series of hostile committee hearings in which it demanded to be given, for once, full and accurate information. To make sure the CIA hadn't secretly used other funds in addition to the $31.7 million, the House Appropriations Committee placed a team of auditors in CIA headquarters to review IA Feature accountings. The new director's first problem was to rein in the free-spending chiefs of station in the field until he could placate the Senate and coordinate an orderly disengagement. On March 12th, he sent a cable to all stations, ordering that no funds whatsoever be expended under the IA Feature program. Abruptly, the chiefs of station in Kinshasa and Lusaka were cut off from all funds. Not even St. Martin would defy such an edict from a new director. High Living, UNITA, and FNLA cadres, mercenaries, agents, collaborators, landlords, hotel managers, and businessmen were suddenly denied further CIA money, even for previously incurred bills. And St. Martin could only bombard headquarters with a series of cables pleading his dilemma. "Our situation is barely short of intolerable," one said. Even so, St. Martin managed the unthinkable. To feed Savimbi's forces, St. Martin had proposed in late February to have I.A. Mouldy I purchase $220,000 worth of combat rations in Rhodesia to be flown from Salisbury to Gago Coutinho. Headquarters had nervously approved this operation, stipulating in repeated cables that other than passing funds to the UNITA representatives, CIA personnel should have no involvement whatsoever with the food lift. UNITA alone should contract with I.A. Mouldy I and make all the arrangements for transportation. Six headquarters cables underscored the importance of the Kinshasa station staying out of it. With Congress closing in, responsibility for a rogue airplane was the last gaffe anybody at Langley wanted. On March 14th and 15th, a mere 3 days after Bush's ultimatum, we began receiving reports of a downed F-27 at Gago Coutinho. The details were not immediately clear, but it seemed very likely that the CIA was liable for the uninsured plane. And so it was. St. Martin had not only ignored the headquarters instructions and managed the food lift himself, he had used Mobutu's precious F-27, the one we had leased, to haul the rations. Fate had intervened in the form of two MiG-21s. On March 13th, while the F-27 was on the ground at Gago Coutinho, having offloaded food and other supplies, the MiGs arrived. Each fired one rocket on the first pass. One of them exploded under the right wing of the F-27, and the other a few meters in front. The pilot and co-pilot, who were in the plane, received minor wounds. As the MiGs made their second pass, one of the French hoods armed and fired an SA-7 rocket. It malfunctioned and plunged back to Earth. A second rocket spiraled into the sky, missing the jet. Direct hits destroyed the F-27. After several more passes at the airport of Gago Coutinho, the MiGs turned to attack the small column of vehicles fleeing to Ninda, 45 kilometers to the south. A rescue operation was quickly mounted, and the pilots were evacuated from Ninda to Runtu, southwest Africa. The French hoods went with them and made their way back to France. 22 had eventually been sent into Angola at a cost of over $500,000. Two had been killed in action. Savimbi disappeared into the Angolan bush. The CIA could have no further contact with him because the European couple had also panicked and fled with the French hoods. On the task force, the consensus was that St. Martin might be disciplined for disobeying orders and losing the plane. The CIA was now liable for a great deal more money than he could include in his monthly accountings, and Congress was angrily examining IA Feature. Worse yet, Jim Potts, St. Martin's tolerant supervisor at headquarters, was away on a trip. Nelson and Colby had retired. The new director was not a member of the club. St. Martin seemed to be in a bit of a jam. Carl Bantam could not conceal his satisfaction as he drafted the first of a series of cables which would bring his escapades to a halt. Betting began. Would St. Martin find a way out? I hedged. Certainly he seemed to be completely boxed in, skewered by his own fine hand. But in every previous confrontation, he had proven more than a match for headquarters. Even without Potts's presence, you could not rule out the possibility that he would find some way to wriggle off the hook. He made it look easy. A cable from Kinshasa advised us that Mobutu was extremely upset about the loss of his plane and was demanding $2 million in restitution, or that the F-27 be replaced by a Boeing 737 jetliner, costing approximately $15 million. St. Martin, headquarters, and Mobutu knew a replacement for the F-27 could be purchased for less than $500,000 in the United States. The working group panicked at the thought of Mobutu's anger. He was notoriously temperamental about large airplanes, which he viewed as symbols of wealth and prestige. He probably knew the MPLA was getting two 737s from the United States at exactly the time he was suffering the humiliation of defeat at their hands. Morale throughout the Zairean army was low, and his regime was seriously threatened from within. He could easily decide to make the United States into a scapegoat for getting him into the war, for leading him on, and for letting him down. He might sever relations and turn completely to the east for support. A 737 jetliner, or even a $2 million restitution, could not be written off by the administration without congressional approval. And the Congress was looking for such an issue to attack the program and expose it to public scrutiny. The CIA would be held to blame for everything. A frantic exchange of cables ensued. Headquarters was only quibbling about the price. Then St. Martin reported that he had managed to see Mobutu and talk him into accepting a $600,000 settlement for the lost plane. Headquarters' reaction was enormous relief and gratitude that St. Martin had gotten the CIA off the hook so lightly. Congress just might approve $600,000. Nothing more was said about St. Martin sending the F-27 into Angola in the first place. Shortly thereafter, St. Martin was promoted to GS-17. He was recommended for an award for his outstanding participation in the Angola program. Footnote. A year later, St. Martin was designated for assignment as chief of station of an important Middle Eastern capital, where the United States spends large sums of money on arms, drug controls, and intrigue. End footnote. In February, the CIA began making generous payoffs to anyone who had been associated with our side of the Angolan War. The original Portuguese-Angolan commandos, who had fought with Bento in northern Angola, were compensated as though they had been on contract as CIA mercenaries throughout the war. Then pilots, boat crews, and propaganda specialists began to line up for bonuses and plane tickets to leave the country. Colonel Castro, of course, received special consideration. He had delivered only 13 men of the 300, but in February he made the novel claim that 126 men had all quit their jobs in preparation for their departures to Angola, and that they must be paid as though they had fought in Angola for the full 5 months. There was no proof these men even existed, and it was known that Castro had been recruiting among the ranks of desperate, unemployed Portuguese-Angolan exiles. But the CIA acquiesced, and on February 25th, Colonel Castro was given $243,600. Including a $110,000 advance in January, this made $353,600 Colonel Castro had received in secret payments in 2 months' time. Footnote. The total bill for the abortive Portuguese mercenary program came to $569,805. End footnote. There was, of course, no assurance that Castro would share the money with anyone, but it was argued that the agency's reputation was at stake. It would be unseemly for us to quibble about it. Eventually, when Director Bush persuaded the congressional committees that all aggressive IA feature activities had ceased, they agreed to a final budget to dispose of $4.8 million, which remained of the $31.7 million, designated as follows. UNITA, $2 million. FNLA, $900,000. Final carrier claims, unpaid transportation bills, $700,000. Wind-up administrative costs, $250,000. Return to agency reserve, $1,031,000. Total, $4,881,000. The $2 million for UNITA was to include such as the following. Final payment to Pearl Air for the Viscount, $146,390. Relocation of 76 UNITA cadres, $104,000. IA Moldy 1 settlement, $120,000. Rhodesian rations, $120,000. Transportation for Rhodesian rations, $96,000. Compensation for the downed F-27, $600,000. Funds for continuing UNITA activities, $540,700. Footnote. The wording which satisfied Congress was to the effect that these funds would be used by Savimbi to resist the total annihilation of his forces by the MPLA. End footnote. Of the FNLA's $900,000, Roberto would receive $836,000, and $64,000 would pay off Portuguese boat crews. In late April, a case officer hand-carried $2.5 million to Kinshasa, but there were technical problems. How does one give $836,000 in cash to a 50-year-old liberation leader at the nadir of his activities without tempting him to retire? And how do you deliver $540,000 cash to another leader who has buried himself in the Angolan hinterlands? The disbursements had to be made promptly, as Congress had decreed there would be absolutely no lingering involvements with Angolan personalities. For a week, we considered having a case officer walk into Angola from Zambia and deliver the money to Savimbi. Case officers, myself included, began to scramble for the assignment, wanting to see Savimbi one last time in his guerrilla redoubt. But the program directors abandoned the idea, fearing the capture of a case officer by the Cubans, and we sought other solutions. Eventually, on April 28, 1976, the money, $1,986,700, was delivered to Mobutu. Of that, $600,000 would be for his lost plane. The rest he could dole to Roberto and Savimbi's representatives in appropriate increments. Conveniently ignored was the fact that Mobutu was as eager as we were to be rid of the liberation movements. It was only a matter of days before UNITA and FNLA leaders were hounding the Kinshasa station, desperate, hungry, their debts still unpaid. Roberto wailed that thousands of displaced FNLA tribesmen in Lower Zaire were starving, and Mobutu refused to receive anyone. He was pocketing their $1,376,700. Footnote. Jim Potts and crew were aware of this potentiality when they ordered the money delivered to Mobutu. They rationalized that it would mollify him, bribe him not to retaliate against the CIA. It is an interesting paradox that the Securities and Exchange Commission has since 1971 investigated, and the Justice Department has prosecuted, several large U.S. corporations for using bribery to facilitate their overseas operations. At the same time, the U.S. government, through the CIA, disburses tens of millions of dollars each year in cash bribes. Bribery is a standard operating technique of the U.S. government via the CIA, but it is a criminal offense for U.S. business. End footnote. The Kinshasa station made a feeble effort to obtain another $1 million from headquarters, but it was over. There was no more money. We were not in the missionary business, and our involvement with the Angolan revolutionaries was ended. On March 24, 1976, a CIA intelligence source, with contacts among the Portuguese exiles in Spain, reported that Colonel Castro was claiming the CIA had welched and refused to provide any funds for him to terminate the PAC force. One of the French hoods angrily claimed that he had not been paid by Bob Denard. Denard denied this, and the two blustered, threatening each other. The IA masks were given a generous bonus and returned to their plantation. Others were not so fortunate. It was, of course, impossible to count the total numbers of Africans who lost their lives during the program. The figures doubtless ran into the thousands. No CIA staffers were killed or suffered any discomfort worse than malaria, but this is normal, as the CIA always operates behind the scenes, letting others run the serious risks. The 13 mercenaries who were captured in northern Angola in February included three Americans: Gustavo Griot, Daniel Gearhart, and Gary Akers were tried as war criminals and sentenced by an international tribunal in Luanda in June 1976. President Ford sent personal messages to President Neto pleading for clemency, to no avail. Gearhart was executed in Luanda on July 10, 1976, and the Italian embassy shipped his body back to his widow and four children in the United States for burial. Akers was sentenced to 30 years in prison. Griot received a lesser sentence. George Bacon III had been killed in an ambush in February. At headquarters, the task force was disbanded, its people moving to other assignments. A nucleus of five was retained for 9 long weeks in case there was an investigation or follow-up activity. With little to do, I began jogging at noontime, running out the back gate and down the George Washington Parkway to Turkey Run Park. There was too much time to reflect on the program and its appalling mediocrity. Nothing had worked. We had delivered into Angola 30,000 sidearms for 10,000 troops, but nothing equal to the enemy's 122-millimeter rocket. The Swift patrol craft never saw action, disintegrating in short weeks of the Zairians' pounding misuse. The 24 rubber boats had been lost. The Sagittarius contributed nothing. Money was wasted on ice plants and fishing boats. Captain Bento's commandos never could be persuaded to raid and patrol. Bob Denard and Colonel Castro had made our case officers look silly in bargaining sessions. The French hoods had fled, months short of contract, at exactly the moment UNITA needed their skills the most. The European couple fled after a week in Angola, depriving us of follow-up intelligence from Savimbi's headquarters. The pack force never materialized. The SA-7 rockets misfired without downing a plane. The French helicopters were delivered without pilots or ground crews. The British-American mercenaries had drawn world attention to the program with shocking psychopathic killings, and the agency's performance of its primary mission of intelligence gathering was conspicuously inadequate. The little stolen Air Force seemed to have done the job, but the air operations officer returned from Kinshasa to write a trip report of bungled air operations and bitter conflict with the Zairians. And finally, the disengagement payoffs were clumsy and wasteful. While certain individuals pocketed almost $2 million, our former allies were left starving. Most serious of all, the United States was exposed, dishonored, and discredited in the eyes of the world. We had lost, and 15,000 Cubans were installed in Angola with all the adulation accruing to a young David who has slain the American Goliath. When Potts returned from his tour of African stations, his secretary staged a surprise early morning coffee and donuts party to welcome him back. She assembled the Africa Division staff, and as Potts walked through the door, everyone began singing, "For he's a jolly good fellow, for he's a jolly good fellow," to his obvious embarrassment. I stood to one side, sipping my coffee and watching. "For he's a jolly good fellow." Potts was a gentleman, correct and polite in his dealings with his staff. He and I were on cordial terms, despite our profound disagreements. But I wondered if Mrs. Gearhart, or the other widows and victims of our program, would think of us as jolly good fellows. Our last task force function was to produce recommendations for awards for everyone who had been involved, over 100 people altogether. The rationale was that, although things hadn't gone very well, we had worked hard, and the defeat was not our fault. Medals and awards would bolster morale. Writing these commendations was the ultimate challenge of my professionalism, for I was in no mood to invent flowery platitudes about the things we had done. But the new director, a consummate politician, had suggested it, and Potts worked out a list of those to be commended. 26 medals and certificates, 140 letters of appreciation, and one meritorious salary increase. It took us weeks. St. Martin, Potts, Colby, and Kissinger, the jolly good fellows. And Stockwell. In another few years, he'll be one too, if he gets his head straight. Postscript. I knew I should resign. My illusions about the intelligence business were dead, but it was difficult to make the move. the CIA was the only world I knew. It provided close friends, financial security, and protection. I came in a way to appreciate Hamlet's dilemma. True, his choices were harder, suicide or murder, while I merely sought the courage to abandon my career and struggled to decide if I should also expose the agency. For months I procrastinated. In the cynical post-Watergate times, why should I be the one to abandon a lucrative and comfortable career and the friends and security that were part of it? Why not just take a cushy field assignment and run off the years until retirement? My jogging increased to 10 miles a day, then 20 one Sunday, down the towpath further and further, and back again. While I vacillated, the Horn and Central Branch was reorganized into a group, and I was appointed the Central Branch Chief, responsible for 7 countries. Angola was one of those countries, and we handled it with a small desk staffed by 2 young officers. Branch Chief was a good job for a GS-14, but I could not get interested either in the work or the prestige. In September, we were summoned to brief the new Deputy Director of Operations, Bill Wells. A colleague made some introductory remarks about the Horn of Africa. Then Brenda McElhenney, the new Ethiopia-Somalia section chief, took the floor and began to describe the situation in her countries. Ethiopia and Somalia were nearly at war. The Soviets had been arming Somalia with modern weapons, jets, tanks, rockets that would fire from the Somali coast to the capital of Ethiopia, and Soviet as well as Cuban advisors. The United States was almost forcing its arms on the not-too-friendly Ethiopian leaders as it sought to confront the Soviet Union. A senior State Department officer at the post had written a letter protesting the expanding U.S. involvement, but it had been suppressed. Wells commented that we should stay on top of the situation. The CIA might well be asked to launch a covert program in the Horn of Africa. When he said that, I spoke out. The Horn wasn't my area of responsibility, but I could not resist. "Sir," I said, "are we really going to do it again? I mean, this war hasn't started yet, and we still have time to get ourselves out of it." He looked at me and laughed outright. "You'd like to win for once, wouldn't you? I know what you mean." He paused and then continued, "But remember, we're professionals. We might well be called on to harass the Soviets while they're making a move in Somalia, just so it won't be easy for them." Footnote. As the world turned, a year later, in the fall of 1977, the Soviets were expelled from Somalia and began to arm Ethiopia. The United States promptly leaped to the Somali side, threatening in February 1978 to arm Somalia if Ethiopia mounted hostile action across the border. This time, however, the State Department prevailed over the CIA option. The United States launched an effort through diplomatic channels to force a cessation of hostilities. End footnote. The CIA was casting about for the next war, amoral, ruthless, eager to do its thing. Its thing being covert little games where the action was secret and no one kept score. But history increasingly keeps score, and the CIA's operations are never secret for long. Inevitably, they are exposed by our press, by whistleblowers in our government, by our healthy compulsion to know the truth. Covert operations are incompatible with our system of government, and we do them badly. Nevertheless, a succession of presidents and Henry Kissingers have been lured into questionable adventures for which they are promised by the CIA they will never be held accountable. Generally, they are not. They move on to sinecures before the operations are fully exposed. Our country is left to face the consequences. Claiming to be our Horatio at the shadowy bridges of the international underworld, the CIA maintains 3,000 staff operatives overseas, approximately equal to the State Department in numbers of staff employees overseas. The CIA extends its influence by hiring dozens of thousands of paid agents. Operationally, its case officers publish or perish. An officer who does not generate operations does not get promoted. The officers energetically go about seeking opportunities to defend our national security. The CIA's function is to provide the aggressive option in foreign affairs. The 40 committee papers for the Angolan operation, written by the CIA, did not list a peaceful option, although the State Department, African Affairs Bureau, and the U.S. Consul General in Luanda had firmly recommended non-involvement. In 1959, the CIA did not recommend to President Eisenhower that we befriend Fidel Castro and learn to live with him in Cuba. No, it presented the violent option, noting that it had the essential ingredients for covert action: angry Cuban exiles, a haven in Guatemala, a beach in the Bay of Pigs, intelligence, later proven inaccurate, that the people of Cuba would rise up in support of an invasion. Presidents Eisenhower and Kennedy were persuaded. The operation was run, and it was bungled. Today we are still haunted by it. At the end of World War II, we were militarily dominant, economically dominant, and we enjoyed a remarkable international credibility. With a modicum of restraint and self-confidence, we could have laid the foundations of lasting world peace. Instead, we panicked, exaggerating the challenge of a Soviet Union which had just lost 70,000 villages, 1,710 towns, 4.7 million houses, and 20 million people in the war. We set its dread KGB as a model for our own alter ego in foreign affairs. In the words of the Hoover Commission report of 1954, quote, "There are no rules in such a game. Hitherto acceptable norms of human conduct do not apply. If the U.S. is to survive, long-standing American concepts of fair play must be reconsidered. We must develop effective espionage and counter-espionage services. We must learn to subvert, sabotage, and destroy our enemies by more clever, more sophisticated, and more effective methods than those used against us. It may become necessary that the American people be acquainted with, understand, and support this fundamentally repugnant philosophy." End quote. It was a tragic, fallacious thesis. Our survival as a free people has obviously not been dependent on the fumbling activities of the clandestine services of the CIA, but on the dynamism of our economic system and the competitive energies of our people. Nor was Hoover's philosophy, quote, "fundamentally repugnant," unquote. Rather, it was irresistible, for it created an exhilarating new game where all social and legal restraints were dissolved. Cast as superpatriots, there were no rules, no controls, no laws, no moral restraints, and no civil rights for the CIA game players. No individual in the world would be immune to their depredations. Friends could be shafted and enemies destroyed without compunction. It was an experiment in amorality, a real-life fantasy island, to which presidents, legislators, and the American people could escape vicariously. Not surprisingly, the mortals of the CIA were unable to cope with such responsibility. Over the years, a profound, arrogant, moral corruption set in. Incompetence became the rule. The clandestine services established a solid record of failure. Failure to produce good intelligence. Failure to run successful covert operations. And failure to keep its operatives covert. And its directors also failed to respect the sacred responsibility they were given of extra-constitutional covert license. Eventually, like any secret police, they became abusive of the people. They drugged American citizens, opened private mail, infiltrated the media with secret propaganda and disinformation, lied to our elected representatives, and set themselves above the law and the Constitution. But our attachment to the CIA's clandestine services nevertheless seems to be unshaken. We still argue that no matter what it does, the CIA is essential to our national security. Where is the ancient American skepticism, the show-me attitude, for which our pioneer forefathers were famous? We only need the CIA if it contributes positively to our national interests. Obviously, our nation needs broad intelligence coverage, and we have been getting it. It comes through the Directorate of Information of the CIA, the Central Intelligence Office, which collates, analyzes, and disseminates information from all sources. Our presidents receive the DDI reports and briefings, and with some misgivings about their quality, insist that they are essential to the wise functioning of that office. But even presidents forget to distinguish between the Directorate of Information and the clandestine services, quite possibly not realizing how little of the DDI's information actually comes from the covert human agents of its shadowy alter ego. The bulk of all raw intelligence, including vital strategic information, comes from overt sources and from the enormously expensive technical collection systems. The human agents, the spies, contribute less than 10%, a trivial part of the information which is reliable and of national security importance. Good agent penetrations of the hard targets, individual spies who have confirmed access to strategic information, who are reliable, and who manage to report on a timely basis, are extremely rare. It is a shocking truth that the clandestine services have failed to recruit good agents in Moscow. Penkovsky and Popov walked in on the British service, which shared them with the CIA. It has failed completely in China, not even a walk-in. In Pyongyang, North Korea, not one Korean agent. And CIA case officers are literally afraid of the mafia, the Chinese Tongs, and the international drug runners. They have recruited scores of thousands of third-world politicians, rebels, and European businessmen, whose voluminous reporting scarcely justifies the clandestine services' existence. In March 1976, President Ford reorganized the National Security Council, renaming the 40 Committee, calling it the Operations Advisory Group. At that time, he expanded the CIA charter, authorizing it to intervene even in countries which are friendly to the United States and in those which are not threatened by internal subversion. In January 1977, at the crest of 2 years of exposure of its shortcomings, misdeeds, and depraved behavior, President Carter announced a reorganization of the intelligence community, which was based on the hypothesis that the clandestine services are essential to our national security. He elevated the position of the Director of Central Intelligence and increased its powers. The offices that have traditionally been responsible for supervising the CIA were renamed. The Congress was reassured that it will receive briefings on CIA activities. Director Turner initiated a house cleaning, dismissing 400 people, so the Directorate of Operations will be, quote, lean and efficient, unquote. The scope of CIA operations is not being reduced, and its overall effectiveness, including the cover of its operatives overseas, is only being upgraded to a slight degree. The clandestine services still have their charter to do covert action. Only 13 overseas positions are being cut. 40 stations and bases will still function in Africa alone, from Nairobi to Ouagadougou, with case officers energetically seeking opportunities to protect our national security. Not Horatio. The clandestine service is an unfortunate relic of the Cold War, entrenched in our government, protected by our self-indulgent, nostalgic commitment to its existence. The CIA presence in American foreign affairs will be judged by history as a surrender to the darker side of human nature. Already we are paying dearly for indulging ourselves. As we have succeeded in making ourselves more like our enemies, more like the KGB, the world has taken note. Throughout Africa, Latin America, and Asia, at least every legitimate American businessman, teacher, and official is suspiciously viewed as a probable CIA operative, capable of dangerous betrayals. The world knows that, in fact, numbers of actual CIA case officers are posing as just such people, while they recruit agents, bribe officials, and support covert adventures. The positive contribution of such activity to our national security is dubious. But mounting numbers of victims, the millions of people whose lives have been trampled or splattered by CIA operations, are increasingly cynical of America. Because of the CIA, the world is a more dangerous place. Americans have reduced credibility. Worst of all, by retaining the CIA, we are accepting ourselves as a harsh and ruthless people. It's the wrong game for a great nation. And the players we've got are losers.